That fear never goes away. I've done 12 books. I've got 10 out. I've got 2 in the hopper. And I'm gearing up for another one. And that fear is there all the time. And the advice I always give is write like no one will ever read this. Because if you do it like you're sitting in your closet with a flashlight, writing secret stuff, you're going to be very brave and audacious and free. And you can censor it back later or whatever if you have to. But when you do it that way, you're not worried about what your parents or your neighbors or your shrink or whatever is going to think about what you did.
This is the Beautiful Writers Podcast. I'm Linda Sievertson, and that was Tosca Lee, the award-winning best-selling author of 10 novels, including the just-released dystopian thriller, The Line Between. With Dean Koontz and Lee Child representing for the gentlemen so well on this show, with their hundreds of millions of copies sold in Hollywood movies, I thought it was high time to bring on a celebrated female in this genre. And guess what? Edward Burns and his Marlboro Road Gang Productions is teaming up with Radar Pictures to develop this new book and The Progeny, another of Tosca's books for television. So yeah. Today's guest co-host came into my life 9 years ago when I met my fiance, because she is his daughter. I can't take any credit for Hailey Baez's beauty or brains, both of which are formidable, but she does call my son her brother, and I am now officially Granny Goose to her baby girl, Hazel, although she and Hayes are the only ones allowed to call me that. Hailey and Tosca are both beauty pageant girls who attribute some of their current success to that early training, as you'll hear. They're both world travelers and, get this, video gamers, although Tosca doesn't get paid for it the way Hailey does. Seriously, you heard that right. Hailey makes a rad living as one of the top female gamers, who's done business with companies like Intel and Sony Pictures and T-Mobile, who love getting in front of her 100,000 plus fans, many of whom also pay money to watch her play. Right? It's a whole new world, you guys. Hailey gives good radio. She wrote popular fan fiction as a kid, and she tells me about great books before anyone else does, like Hunger Games, before it was a thing. She's read the entire Harry Potter series maybe 15 times. I'm thinking J.K. Rowling needs to come on this show and see if she can beat Hailey in a Potter World trivia contest. I think it'd be close. Hales and I have had the best time reading The Line Between and freaking out about the characters, the plot, the ending, and the sequel to come. Thank you so much for being here and sharing this next hour with us. I know you're going to love these two like I do by the time we're done. Welcome.
First, I just have to say thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk to you both.
We're so excited. Hailey and I are obsessed with your book. We love it so much.
I literally blew through it in a day. It was one of those that I just like couldn't stop, couldn't put it down. My husband was like, what are you doing? Like, he's not a reader. He doesn't have the same kind of mindset, I guess, that I do when it comes to books. And so it like baffles him that I can sit down and read a book for an entire day. And he's like totally astounded by it. So sure enough, that was how I spent my Saturday. And I loved it. We're really excited.
Awesome. And you have a 7-month-old baby, Hailey. So that's like no joke, sitting down all day and reading.
She was his job for the day. I was like, bye, have fun. I'll be in my office.
Love it.
Okay, guys. So before we get to writing stuff and the new book stuff, you two have a few things in common, which is why I wanted to put you guys together. You have beauty pageants in your history. You're travel obsessed. You have a serious video game habit. Like, what the hell? I've never played a video game in my life. Can someone please tell me what the allure is of shooting fake people? Because don't you guys have enough other real world stuff to do?
Well, yes.
That's fair. Well, for me, I mean, that's what I do for my job is video games. And so it's very easy for me to get sucked in because I don't feel that I'm neglecting a lot of other responsibilities. And I purposely do it around the time that I know my daughter's asleep, and so I can dedicate time to it. But even before it was my job, it's fun. I think it's almost like a relief. It's
a stress reliever.
Yeah, it totally is, right? Yeah.
Killing people is a stress reliever.
You make it sound so gruesome.
Call of Duty, you guys.
It's not that bad.
I don't know how to explain it any better than that. It's a stress reliever.
Really? And you have three boys, Tosca, right?
Yeah. So that's to play these current video games. It's not something I would normally do on my own, but because, you know, I used to be a gamer online, but we used to do role-playing games and stuff back in the early days. But these games, I'm not very good at them, but I do it to spend time with my boys.
Yeah.
What games did you role-play?
Well, it was free-form role-playing. So back in the early days of AOL, we had chat rooms that we did that in.
Oh, you're talking early, early days.
talking like dial-up modems. Yeah.
Oh, man. Oh, my God.
I like to call those the dark ages.
The dark ages, yeah. It was after decades of D&D at the table, so it was kind of modern, but still all you had was a chat room.
Yeah.
Yeah, no avatars, no nothing.
Haley learned to play with her father. He loves to tell stories, Haley, about how the two of you would sit in his office at your own consoles. And he would go to the bathroom and he would come back and Haley, as a 4-year-old, had killed everybody. All the people were online, right? They were live. And Haley's like killing people and just laughing. And he's walking and going, she's 4.
He's like, I'm so proud.
Oh, yeah. Sure enough, we still play games. I mean, we play different games now, but that's how I know he spends his time unwinding, is sitting down on his computer playing Diablo. And it's very easy. Like, it's a large demographic of people who I think feel the same way. So I don't think we're alone, Tosca. Don't worry.
I have a client who, like the two of you, is a blessed combination of heart and beauty and brains. And she ended up putting herself through flight school with money that she won. She was crowned Miss California. And then she used that training to become an Air Force pilot and eventually did a bunch of tours in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Wow.
So where I'm going with this is that beauty pageants are often a means to another end. And okay. I would love to know more about how the two of you use that path and how it's enhanced what you're doing now or not. Tosca, you want to start?
Well, I say often that the pageant experience I had has contributed so much to this career, this writing career, because I learned how to interview. I learned how to go out and be on the radio and be on TV and talk to people. I'm an introvert by wiring. So that's how I learned to really get out in front of people. But also that's how I learned too that it's really about being of service. So it's a very strange means to a very good end, because it's about getting out into the community and doing these charitable events, but it's also carried over as far as the writing, because it helps me know too that these stories that I'm writing, they're not about me. This career is not about me. This career is about getting out in front of readers and giving them those stories that they turn to fiction for, the escapes that they're turning to great books for, because they are helping people through tough times in their lives, whether it's a divorce or taking care of an aging parent or any difficult time. I've had many readers say that they read my books while they were in the hospital. I think that the pageant experience was great training for so much.
Mm. And Haley, I've watched you. I mean, I've been in the audience when Haley was runner-up for Miss Arizona, and I've seen you do so many things for public speaking. Haley, you're so well-spoken. And do you think that that helped as well?
Thank you. You're very sweet. I mean, definitely. I think what I do for streaming, I live stream video games on a website called Twitch.
Oh, and yeah. I know Twitch.
So, okay. So, you know Twitch. Great. So I'm a Twitch streamer. And most people hear live streaming and they ask if I still have my clothes on. So, I always like to explain, now I'm playing video games. But I think a lot of the presence that you have to have when it comes to broadcasting, whether that's in news or that's on Twitch or public speaking on stage, I think you can learn a lot from pageantry. And I think that's kind of where a lot of my skill, for that, I guess you'd call it skill, where a lot of that stems from, is from competing in beauty pageants. And especially with interviews, whether it's a job interview or for my job, this kind of interview, I think that I learned a lot of those skills from practicing with a panel of judges.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
to whether or not that's still a proper thing to say as part of the 2019 Me Too movement, you know, as a whole other subject, but the skills that we learned as far as speaking publicly when it comes to interviewing, I think are vital. And I can't attribute that to really anything else. Mm. So I'm glad I did it. Would I want my daughter to compete in them? Like I said, I don't know quite yet, because that's a very internal battle for me for a lot of reasons. But ultimately, I'm glad I did it. It was a fun chapter in my life. I recently just judged the Miss Utah USA pageant, which was really cool getting to see the other side of things and how the winners are selected. And it brought me, I think, a really good sense of enjoyment to be able to know how it goes on the other side, but also to be able to know that I think I picked a really great person to represent her state. So ultimately, I think it paid off in the end.
I think judging is really nerve-wracking, though. I have sat there in the judge's chair as they were getting closer and closer. And I knew who I was voting for, but you don't know who's going to win because you don't know what the other judges did. And literally, I thought I was going to have a heart attack because I was getting so nervous for them. And I could have gotten up and walked out, I probably would have just because I didn't know if I was going to make it. That's really nerve-wracking.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, totally. And you know what it's like to be on both sides. You know what it's like to be the one competing. And I think that's what makes it so nerve-wracking is because you know how those girls feel up there, right?
Yes.
Haley, when your dad and I were in the audience and you were up there with the last three girls, and you're all holding hands and they're asking you questions and they ask tough questions. So they ask Haley, I don't remember what it was. I think it was a pretty political question. And our hearts were in our throats. We're just sitting there and we knew she could do it, but you never know until you open your mouth what's going to come out, right?
It's true.
Scary. Oh, I hated it. I was so scared.
It's like that. I don't know if you guys have seen The Office, but it's like that Michael Scott quote when he just starts rambling and he's like, you know what? Sometimes I just start speaking and I hope I find my way along the way. I hope I end up where I end up needing to be. Yep. So Tosca, at what point did you actually know that you wanted to be a working writer?
You know, I really wanted to be a ballerina most of my life. And
you're kidding.
No, that was my driving ambition until about 14. And I tore a groin when I was 14. And that's a really kind of tough injury. It sets you back quite a ways. And by the time I was 16, I knew I was going to go off to college and do something else. And it was after spring break, my freshman year, I went to Smith College and then I came home during spring break. Who goes home to Nebraska over spring break? And I was with my dad and I was talking about one of my favorite books of all time, which was The Mists of Avalon, which is this huge, long book. Fantasy book about the women behind King Arthur's throne. And I was talking about how great books are like roller coasters and they've got twists and turns and these emotional highs and lows. And I just blurted out, I think I'd like to write a book because I just wanted to know if I could build a roller coaster like that for someone else to enjoy.
Wow.
And my dad said to me that day, okay, look, I was supposed to spend the summer working at a bank as a bank teller, and I was a terrible teller. I'm terrible with numbers and I could never balance my drawer or anything. So it was awful. And my dad said, I will make you a deal. I will pay you what you would have made this summer as a bank teller if you will spend the summer writing your first novel.
Amazing.
And I was
really,
and I was all over it. I was like, yep, I'll do it. So I wrote my first novel that summer. And of course I had to take on this super historical novel about the Neolithic people of Stonehenge, right? So in addition to the novel part, I had all this research stuff and it was like, wow, this is really hard. So I did it. And the following summer, I submitted it to Writer's House, which is a New York agency, and made every single mistake in the book. This is back in the day when you had to print and send the whole manuscript in a paper box. So it's like a ream of paper and you're not supposed to bind it. Well, I bound it. You're not supposed to put a cover on it. I put a cover on it with a picture of Stonehenge and, and you have to send your self-addressed stamped envelope so they can send everything back. Well, finally I got this letter back and the person who was reading their slush pile said, even after reading the 23-page synopsis, I read a 23-page synopsis. Never write a 23-page synopsis. even after reading this 23-page synopsis, I'm still not sure what this book is about.
No.
Your characters are two-dimensional and the plot lacks tension, blah, blah, blah. What I picked out from that rejection letter was the single line where they said, but it is strangely reminiscent of Clan of the Cave Bear, which was another one of my favorite books. And I just remember thinking, my book is like Clan of the Cave Bear.
That's such a great thing to take from a rejection letter. Are you kidding me? Like most people would be like so disappointed that they got a rejection letter. And you took the one thing that was like so positive from that and took it Like, how amazing is that?
I love it. No, it wasn't the result I wanted. I wanted them to be like, oh, well, we have to represent you. But I took that away and I was like, I'm so doing this again.
Oh,
I love
there
it.
There it was.
And how long was it after that that you did it again?
I worked on a novel for 9 years after that. And that was based off of one of my role-playing characters, actually. So 9 years, and I never quite finished it. And while I was working on that, I started another novel about a fallen angel. And that was also while I was hunting around for a role-playing character. And wrote that in 6 weeks. And I thought, well, maybe this one is meant to be. And so I sent that one in. And it took 6 years before it was published. So between that first one, that was 1989. I'm dating myself here. 89 that I wrote that. And it was 2006 when my first novel was finally published.
I can't get over the fact that you wrote a novel in 6 weeks.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Well, it's doable.
That makes me think of National Novel Writing Month.
Which you, Haley, you did it.
I did. I did the word count. I didn't finish the novel, right. But I just know how much of a commitment that was.
Yeah.
So to be able to do an entire one finished complete, whether it was the published version or not, in that short of a time frame is incredibly impressive.
Yeah, well, it is.
Thank you. But if you don't know how long it really takes to write a novel, then you don't know that you're doing something difficult, you know?
Sure.
And I didn't really know. So of course, the last one I'd been working on for 9 years, but you know, but
you know, 9 years, 6 weeks, same thing, pretty much. Tosca, I wanted to touch on what you mentioned about your dad and how he paid for you to write your novel. Is that something that you would do for your kids?
Absolutely. I think that was such a cool thing. And what a great investment. I will always be grateful for that. So absolutely, in a heartbeat. Yeah.
I love it.
I remember my dad told me when I was like 9, and I spent a weekend at my mother's Selectric typewriter writing The Adventures of Grupal, the Magical Banana. And Grupal took on an entire town of thugs that were trying to steal the town of Banana Town. And anyway, I was totally obsessed with this story and I illustrated it and I typed it all up and I gave it to my father to read, and he had tears in his eyes and he said, I will treasure this. I will keep it safe. And one day I will publish it for you. And I'm 9 years old thinking, okay, daddies know everything. That means I'm going to be a writer. I just, right. I knew it. I was like, okay, like that's the word of God right there.
Yeah.
And he put it in his file cabinet, and before he died, he found it and he sent it to me. I was living in New Mexico and he sent it to me, and I still have it on my desk.
Oh, I love that.
That makes me want to cry.
How have I never seen this? I need to see this when I'm with you next.
You have it? I've never told you. I will show it to you. No, it's a series. I actually wrote a whole series about Banana Town and Grupal the Wizard.
My heart. Okay, so Tosca, before you became a writer, what were some of your first jobs? Did any of them form or shape your writing? Maybe like working in a graveyard or handing vials of a virus that could wipe out humanity to a crazy dude who runs a cult? Like, tell me about it.
I spent 2 weeks as a bus girl at Red Lobster.
Oh, no.
That was my very first job. And I was like, I don't know.
Well, you could get food poisoning. That's not a virus to wipe out humanity, well, but that could be food poisoning.
You know, I used to write on the staff of Smart Computing magazine. That was my first job out of college. So I knew by then I wanted to write. That wasn't exactly the kind of writing I wanted to do, but it was the closest thing to a writing job I could find. So I did that, and I learned a lot about the publication process for magazines and also for books, because I wrote a couple computer books during that time as well.
Of course you did.
It was so random. This company approached me and asked me to do it. So it was very educational. But from there, I was married before, and I spent several years staying at home and just pursuing writing. And so I didn't work. And then towards the end of that marriage, I took a job with the Gallup organization and I started to teach and speak for them. And so I think that that helped me a lot as far as going out and being able to teach and talk about writing and teach workshops about writing. But I can't say that I was ever like in a cult or never worked with pandemics. And my sister's a doctor, so she's kind of my go-to for some of those.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's convenient, especially for this book. Yeah. Especially. Yeah.
I'm like, I'm really sorry. I don't know if I'm asking you to violate your Hippocratic oath by helping you design this designer virus and killer pandemic.
It's so good. So the line between your new book, your hero, Winter Ross, she's cast out of a doomsday cult. Mm-hmm. She was raised in it. There's this mysterious outbreak of a rapid early onset dementia that's spreading across the entire country. And this is the apocalypse, right? That the cult right. leader talked about all her life. And for the reader, for Haley and me, it feels so frighteningly real. I mean, you've created something, I think because I'm in the safety of my home and because you're such a good writer and the characters are so lovable and we're rooting for them, it's not too scary to go down this path right. because we know it's not happening. However, for you as the person who's writing it and you're having to research how to create this pandemic, did it ever feel like a little too real?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was inspired by headlines, actually, because there's this...
The permafrost there was this melting.
Case. Yeah, there was a deer that melted in the Siberian permafrost
yep.
and it was filled full of anthrax and it made a whole village sick. And there's many headlines where scientists are speculating what's in the permafrost and what could come out of it. So it was inspired by real concerns about real events. So that part is scary. And the prion disease part is real too. So the disease is a prion disease, which is what mad cow is. Mm-hmm. Prion diseases, you right now you can't really test for them until someone has passed away, then you can test the brain for it. But it is always fatal. And you basically, it makes holes in your brain and you get dementia, you go crazy.
Which is terrifying.
It's terrifying.
And I think that probably my favorite part, not my favorite part of the book, because there's so many favorite parts of the book, but one of my favorite parts was actually your author's note where you listed all of these different headlines and links to articles to show that even though this is fiction and it's entertaining and it's a thriller,
yeah,
there's nothing to say that this couldn't possibly happen one day, especially with the temperatures rising and the permafrost melting and who knows what there's, especially if there, as you mentioned, there is no test for prion disease, there's a very real potential for this to eventually take place.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's scary stuff. Yep. Scary.
I know. It's intense, but I love the way that you write your suspense. So do you plot your storylines out ahead of time or how do you draft them?
This is something I've had to experiment with a little bit. I've learned that I really do need something of an outline. Now, that said, I don't do a super detailed outline, but I need enough of a roadmap to know where I'm going. That said, though, whenever I outline, there's a big difference between 30,000 feet in the air and boots on the ground, right?
Yeah.
So when you're looking down, that's one thing. And it's like a video game, Haley, right? So you're like literally down there and your vantage point changes and you can look down those dark alleys. It's different. And so in the process of writing, things change and things happen. I like leaving room for that kind of mysterious stuff that happens in the process.
Yeah.
Do you ever find yourself getting stuck? Like in cases where you're like, I want this to happen, but I don't know how to get there.
Sometimes, but I'm really fortunate in that I've got some great resources in my husband and I've got some writer and editor friends who are great at brainstorming. So I know that I can always sit down with my husband or call somebody up and say, help me out here. I'm stuck. Think through this.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And typically you write long. I've heard you say that you don't write anything under 150,000 words and your nature is to overwrite, which girl, boy, do I feel ya. Yeah. Right now, the memoirs and business books that my friends are writing are all at about 80,000 words. Mm. And I'm like, how do you write 80? I can't seem to ever get in under 120.
Yeah.
I'm working on it, but it's so hard for me. I guess my question to you is this how you end up with a series? Does it start out as one book and yet it just keeps getting bigger and bigger?
No, I write the one and then I trim it back. I'm always trimming. I like that part, actually. I like culling
yeah,
it back.
I do too.
And I do tend to write long. But then when I'm getting ready for the second book, I think the smart thing to do would be to plan the whole series out at once. But I've never done that. I don't know if that's just a lack of discipline on my part. But whenever I'm getting ready for the second book, I have to kind of pick up from where I was and say, okay, now that this is where we are, how do we get ourselves out of this mess?
Sure. Pressure. Oh, that's funny. And 20 hours a day, seriously. I've heard that when you're in a book and you're on a deadline, you can go 20 hours a day.
20, sometimes 24. Your body hurts when you sit that much and when you're writing that much. I mean, well, everything hurts. It gets harder too, the older I get. But I think that's just kind of how I do it. The closer I get to deadline, the more hours I'm putting in. And then like the last week, I quit washing my hair and quit bathing. And I posted a pet for my husband. When I finished the line between, I was like, okay, I'm done. And he said, that's great. Does this mean you'll bathe now? So,
yeah. You were a honeymooner when you finished.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of deadlines, how are the edits for the sequel going? Or are they done? Because it publishes in September, right?
Yes, it's done. And I've got this stack of paper. Yeah, I'm just going through the final proof pages right now.
Haley and I are already trying to figure out what's happened.
Oh.
The last line that you have in the first chapter is like a teaser for the sequel. I'm like, Haley, do you think it's not really bad, right? She's just glitching us right now. She's just teasing. It's not really going to be bad.
Oh, yeah. I was like, it's too early in the book for something this bad to happen. It won't be the first chapter, so I'm not too concerned, but you never know.
And I'm like, the dog. No, the dog.
I know. Poor puppy. Oh, my God. I love Buddy. Buddy's so cute.
I love Buddy, too. And I have to tell you, in the second book, I wrote a character who has become one of my favorite characters of all time.
Yes.
I'm really excited for you to meet this new character. So, yeah.
Well, and it's exciting to, I don't want to spoil anything for those who haven't read the book yet.
Yeah.
Because obviously with where Winter is, there's an opportunity to meet a lot of new people. So I'm very excited to get to know all of these new people and see kind of how they all do together without giving away too much.
Winter, who is the main character, she's named after my stepdaughter, actually.
I was going to ask that.
Yeah.
I was going to ask because you have such unique names in here. Truly Winter that are have really also pretty spellings. The Y in Winter is beautiful. I was going to ask where the inspiration for those names came from.
Well, a lot of them come from my readers. So I will ask them who would like to maybe be in this book and they'll leave comments on social media. And the thing is, I reserve the right to make them a jerk or kill them. So that's...
Like, just so you know, this is what you're getting yourself into.
Right. And they're much more eager to be killed than be a jerk, but they're far too eager to get killed in fiction. It's really odd. But Winter is my stepdaughter, and I just thought it'd be cool to do that. And it's really cool when I read reviews and people say, oh, Winter's such a kick-ass heroine. And so it's fun to read that, and I'd like to pass that on to her.
It's an honor. That's an honor what that is to be written into a book, even if you are killed at the end of it.
No kidding. And I love her so much. She actually reminds me a little bit of Jane Hawk. Have you had a chance to read the Jane Hawk series, Dean Koontz? Oh, so good.
To.
And I used to read thriller a lot when I was a kid, and then I got out of the habit. And then with the podcast, when Dean Koontz's people reached out to me, his publisher, I said, okay, I think I'm a little scaredy cat, but maybe it's time to jump back into this genre. And I'm so glad I did because Jane Hawk was my entree back in, and she's a rogue FBI agent trying to save her son from a horrible, evil, worldwide plot. And she's so kick ass and you just love her so much and she just kills so many bad guys. So I'm already in the Jane Hawk mindset when I meet Winter. And so Winter just feels like an old friend now. She feels like she's a sister to Jane Hawk.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. And I'm glad to hear you're reading thrillers again because it's fun. I like the uniqueness of that genre, you know, as far as the pacing. And of course, Dean Koontz, that's not to love. And one of my favorite thrillers is, I think it was Watchers.
Yes.
With the dog Einstein in it.
Yes. Yeah. And also Lee Child. I got into Jack Reacher because of the podcast. And now I'm a huge Jack Reacher fan as well.
Yeah.
I'm so glad to have you with us. We needed a woman to represent.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to represent.
Definitely. So you're a god girl, Tosca. Do you feel like you're channeling when you're writing? Is this a co-creation?
That's a really interesting question because a lot of times I'm writing and it's kind of like, where did that come from? I don't know that I would have come up with that on my own. So I would say yes, often I feel like that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Nice.
And I do think God creates with us. So I believe that we are made in the image of the most creative being in the universe. When people say to me, well, I'm not creative. I always say, oh no, you are, because it's part of your legacy. It's in your DNA.
Yes.
To be creative, right?
I love that. And how much of that do you think translates into The Line Between? Because so much of it is focused on religion, even though it's not necessarily a real religion in this case, especially with a character like Magnus, who essentially says the same thing, but is the complete opposite. How do you think that translates?
Well, you know, The Line Between is really about leaps of faith. And I think that so much of what we mistake for religion is rules and things that are prescribed. I feel like the true faith is taking that step, not knowing if the sidewalk's going to be under your foot, but taking it anyway.
Yeah.
So it's really about getting away from different kinds of spiritual abuses and stepping out in faith and allowing room for mystery, which is uncomfortable, I think, for most of us, many of us, especially if you're like me and you've grown up in a church that gave you many of the answers or told you what the answers should be. And I think it can be very uncomfortable to leave room for that mystery to happen. But I do believe that God is a mysterious God.
That's a great line. I believe God is a mysterious God.
Yeah.
I love those too.
Bingo.
Yeah.
And I also hear that The Line Between is being made into a movie.
It's in development for television. Yep. It's being developed for TV. So that's exciting.
Oh my gosh. And tell me about the process with that.
You know, the process is, I'm learning as we go. We've got another series. We, meaning the production team, is working on another one of my books, The Progeny. So I'm really happy to be working with these same producers on The Line Between. And it is a long process. It's a matter of getting people attached and, you know, names attached as far as writers and showrunners and talent and all that stuff and pitching it to networks. And it takes time and they are very tenacious. And I'm very grateful to be working with these producers. They're from Radar Pictures and Ed Burns's team from Marlboro Road Gang Productions. So
such great, these are great people to be working
they
with.
They are great people. Yeah.
That's amazing. And congratulations
on that,
of course.
Thank you.
And it kind of makes me think of how people need to relate to like published works and have characters that they really care about translate onto television. And Harry Potter is a lot of what that reminds me about because I'm a huge fan. I'm like a huge Harry Potter fan. And, you know, I think they did such a great job of that with the films because those are very, very long, detailed books.
Yeah.
And to be able to translate it as much as they did, even though they had to obviously cut certain bits and pieces out of it, was really impressive. And so it kind of reminds me of just, I don't know, I've read these books so many times and I care so much about them. And I wanted to know if you have anything as far as a literary obsession that's similar.
Well, the Harry Potter books and movies are amazing. I did just go to Harry Potter World for the first time last year and I was...
Oh my God, what did you think?
I was blown away. And I had to step back and think to myself, okay, this all came out of a book and this all came out of one woman's imagination.
Yeah.
So that's crazy, right? When you're standing there looking up at Hogwarts or in Diagon Alley and it's just mind blowing. So
it really does.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that you just kind of have to wrap your, especially because she got the idea when she was on a train looking out at a field of cows.
Yeah.
It wasn't even like it was just a sudden, like, she had a dream about it. No, she was just gazing out at a field of cows and all of a sudden she just thought of it. Like, oh, okay, just super casual. Just casually think of this entire universe. That's amazing.
I love driving and traveling for that reason because I think your mind is finally free to just play and wander during a busy day packed full of stuff. I don't think it does that, you know?
Agreed.
So that's why I think traveling is so important. But yeah, literary obsessions, I bounce around all the time. I recently read Blake Crouch's Black Matter, which I loved. Mm. It was mind-bending and smart. And
I've heard of it. I haven't read it yet.
Oh, it's so good. An Anonymous Girl is the one that I'm listening to right now. I bounce around, but I always have to have some story. Whether it's a TV show, whether it's a book, there always has to be something going. And I like the TV to be on a movie, even if I'm not watching it, even if I'm not in the same room. I like it to be on a movie. One of those great things.
So you just like an infusion of story all the time.
Yeah, I do.
You know, that reminds me, my son was over the other day and he's a graduate of film school. And I was telling him about a chapter that I'm writing for one of my books right now. And he mentioned, he was like, Mom, you're at the part of the hero's journey where the hero gets the call and rejects the call. And yeah. I said, yeah, you know, I was impressed that he knew. And I was like, oh God, Tosh, you must know all about that because like I paid for film school. And he goes, Mom, and he pulls out his computer and he shows me this massive document he had written on the hero's journey. It was like 40 pages long where he had broken down a story and then he actually had his own interpretive spin on it. And he was saying, you know, maybe one day I'll publish this. He and I published a book together with your publisher, with Simon & Schuster, when he was 17. And it was a book actually on the environment. But at any rate, so he was like, you know, maybe I'll publish this one day. I think it'll help people. But it made me think because I was reading The Line Between at the same time when he came over and we had this conversation. And I thought, I wonder, when you're writing your books, Tosca, are you thinking of the different stages that quote unquote should happen to a character in specific places? Or are you just so adept at telling a story, you just naturally kind of put things in the right places?
Oh, I wish that I could say that. I'm thinking of the character's journey and arc. So I am thinking of that and thinking about what happens to the character. But I do take some time to sit down and say, okay, here's where she needs to start her journey. And a lot of time it really is a physical journey of traveling somewhere, moving somewhere. I also think about the arc as far as the character making progress towards a goal and then coming up short.
Oh, sure.
As far as the three act structure goes, and I'm very conscious of that three act structure. So I do try to plan around that.
Yeah. And is there a particular book that you could recommend for our listeners who want to learn more about the three act structure? Where did you learn this?
Michael Haig. So he teaches about the three act structure. And if you just search him up, H-A-G-U-E, Michael Haig, he teaches on that. Fabulous. I've been to his workshops. The other book that I really always recommend for fiction authors, for novelists, is Donald Moss's Writing the Breakout Novel.
Oh, what a cool title.
Yes, Writing the Breakout Novel. And there's a workbook, and that workbook is invaluable. So for those listening, if you want to write a novel, do yourself a favor and get that workbook.
Mm, great.
I'm literally going on Amazon right now as we talk about it to order it.
It is fabulous. And I'm weird about the workbook. I won't write in it because you can't write. I mean, it's got lines, but I don't want to write in it. I got to keep it nice, right?
So do you write in another notebook?
Yes.
The answers on a separate one?
I don't write in the book. I have to keep it nice so I can use it for the next time. But it's fabulous. Absolutely fabulous.
Mark my words, Tosca. Haley, who was writing fan fiction as a little kid that was really, really good. Haley's going to write something pretty killer in the next 10 years. I don't know what it is, but I can promise.
I'm excited. I want a copy when you do. So
I appreciate your faith in me. I really do. But when it comes to writing, at least personally, I know that I have a lot of my own personal fears and my own nerves about the whole process just because I'm so inexperienced. But I'm curious to know if you have, I know that you have your own twin demons about fear and perfectionism when it comes to creating. Can you talk a little bit about that and how writers tend to be fragile people? I know I feel that way at least.
Ditto.
Yeah, writers, I think we feel very deeply. So in that way, I feel like, yes, we are fragile. We care what people think. But you know, it takes a pretty intrepid soul to go out and go on that adventure and to put the time in and to keep working at it because it takes a lot of work to write. So the advice that I always give people as they sit down, that fear never goes away. I've done 12 books. I've got 10 out. I've got two in the hopper.
Jeez.
And I'm gearing up for another one. And that fear is there all the time. And the advice I always give is write like no one will ever read this. Because
I love it.
If you do it like you're sitting in your closet with a flashlight, writing secret stuff, you're going to be very brave and audacious and free. And you can censor it back later or whatever if you have to. But when you do it that way, you're not worried about what your parents or your neighbors or your shrink or whatever is going to think about what you did.
Yeah.
So
I hadn't even thought about that. I hadn't even gotten that far into the process of the idea of everybody else reading it.
So I'm
No, but you're right. Because even my husband, like I have a notebook that I write things in and he picked it up the other day and was like, what's in this? And he started to read it. And I grabbed it from him. I'm like, excuse me. No. And he's like, well, what? Why can't I read it? And I didn't really have an answer to give him. I was just like, I don't know. It's just, it's personal. It's not there. It's not ready. I don't know.
It's
I didn't
not
have
polished.
An answer.
I mean, it's not, it's like letting someone see your cellulite, you know?
Yeah, it's very deeply personal.
It is.
Okay, I'm glad I'm not the only one to feel that way. Because I couldn't give him an answer as to why my honest answer was, I don't know why you can't read it, because I don't know why I feel this way. But I think that ends up putting a bit of perspective into it for me. So thank you.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. All right, Haley, I want you to lead us through our rapid fire. This is the part, Tosca, where you just kind of give the first answer that comes to your mind. It'll be kind of quick.
Okay.
It's going to be fun. Don't worry. We'll make it good. Okay, ready?
Yeah.
Yep.
Do you watch the news or do you get enough gore in your day job?
I don't watch the news. I get it off of Facebook and social media and Snapchat and The Daily Show.
Yep, me too. 2, zombie apocalypse or pandemic?
Zombie apocalypse.
Ooh. When you're writing about demons, do you sleep with a cross over your bed?
No. Maybe I should.
I mean, you never know, right?
But no. Now you tell me.
Just for future reference. Okay, 4, your favorite way to kill a character.
Oh, gosh. I always thought if you stab somebody with an icicle, there'd be no murder weapon, so.
Oh, that's good.
You're right. Yeah. I've heard that one before.
I haven't done it, but, you know.
When you're pissed off, do you think your husband ever sleeps with one eye open?
No, but I do think there are spouses of thriller writers and mystery writers that probably should. And you know that you've got a really close friend when they call you up and they're pissed at their spouse. And the first thing they say is, help me bury the body.
Yeah, how do I do it? You know these things. Okay, best thing about being a girl?
Oh, wearing dresses. I hate to say it, but I like wearing dresses.
Dresses are great. Yeah. Love them. Most ridiculous or heinous pageant experience? I'm ready for this one.
Duct taping boobs.
Yep. Yep. Or vaginas for that matter. You don't want camel toe.
You taped your vagina? Oh,
yeah. Absolutely.
What do you mean?
Do you want camel toe on stage?
Oh!
Hey, you ass. Okay. What do you do when an author friend writes a book you don't like? Do you lie, say you didn't read it, or change the subject?
I would probably, I hate to say this, I would probably lie.
I would too.
Probably shouldn't say that. But
well, if it's done, if it's done, what are you going to do? But if it's not done, I have the fabulous, fabulous job of telling people constantly that they're not ready, which sucks. It's horrible. I hate this part of my job. However, what I have found is because I've been not ready before and I've put my own work out before spilling my popcorn all over the lobby, I can go to them and say, look, I don't want you to do what I've done. And you know what? Everybody kind of knows. They know that they're not ready. They don't want to know it, but they know it. So when you tell them, they're relieved. But God forbid, if the book is done, what are you going to do? You got to lie, right? Ugh.
Yeah, too late. Too little, too late.
It's horrible.
Okay, last one. So you're Asian.
Yes.
Were you a Crazy Rich Asians fan before the movie we all loved?
No, I wasn't. I didn't really even know about it until the movie came out. But then, of course, I went and saw it and I loved it. And
I've seen it twice.
Yeah.
I love it.
And I felt like I identified with different parts of it so much. It was kind of like my Big Fat Greek Wedding. I mean, I don't care what ethnicity you are. You can identify with parts of that movie.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally. Oh, I've got one more. Do you believe the world is coming to an end, that we're arranging deck chairs on the Titanic, or that we'll all save ourselves in the 11th hour?
I would like to think that we will all save ourselves in the 11th hour.
I hope so too. It's dramatic, isn't it? It's a good storyline.
It's a very dramatic, yeah.
So a lot of your, at least for The Line Between, a lot of your book has a ton of research in it. And Queen of Sheba comes to mind when it comes to your historical research. So how do you go about doing that?
Well, I like to recruit a lot of experts because I've found that it's very valuable to have that person kind of on speed dial where you can quickly ask a question. I think it helps too when you can basically say, okay, here's what I need to know. Here's what I'm going to be writing. Can you give me a syllabus basically so I can study? So you start with a syllabus from an expert telling you, here are the sources you need to know, and here's what you need to read. So you're not wasting your time, because when you're dealing with deadlines, that's the tough thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. How do you find these experts?
That's a really good question. one thing that I've done is there's a company called The Teaching Company, and they put out lectures and courses by world-renowned academics. And so I will peruse their catalog, especially for the history section.
And what's it called?
The Teaching Company.
She's online.
Oh, yeah. I'm totally writing all this down. I need to know this thing. This is really references.
Yeah, the great courses by the Teaching Company. The great courses, I think.
Yeah, and it's phenomenal.
Yeah, it's great. iTunes University, tons of podcasts there. Lectures, again, from great institutions, colleges, universities. Also, documentaries and TV specials. I look to see who they're interviewing, and I write those names down, and then I reach out to them.
So
that's
cool.
Awesome.
You know, I am a big audiobook listener. And I think Cassandra Campbell's voice is an absolute dream.
She's so good.
I was so happy she narrated this book. For those of you who don't know her, she narrated Where the Crawdads Sing, Bird Box. She's narrated another one of your books. How does it feel to listen to someone like her make your words come to life?
It's so cool because I listened to, you'd think I'd be kind of sick of this book, and I kind of am sick of the book by the time I've done all the edits. When I read it again, but it's really fun to listen to the audiobook because it's, you hear it in a new way.
Yeah.
And you hear the sentences with cadences that are different than the way that you heard it. And it's neat to experience it through someone else's filter and hear it in that way.
Haley, you'd be a good audiobook narrator.
Not thank you. Well, I was going to say, I sound like I lost my voice over the weekend, which is why I sound kind of froggy, but I appreciate that you still feel that way. Thank you. And no, it's funny that you bring that up though, because I mentioned my husband earlier and how he's not big on reading books,
but he
loves audiobooks. Yeah. Yes, he absolutely listens. In fact, the only way I got him to read the Harry Potter series was through audiobooks. But do you feel that when it comes to audiobooks that you don't retain as well as you would if you were actually reading a physical copy of the book?
It's definitely a different experience because there are things that are very different when they're spoken that were not meant to be spoken possibly when the author wrote it. So for me, it is a little bit harder to retain certain things. I like the experience of looking at a page.
And I like to underline everything. So I do both.
I like to underline. I like to write in books too, except for the Donald Moss workbook. But
I can't do that. I can't. Like the idea of marking up is because I have the line between in my hands right now. And the idea of marking it up like gives me anxiety. It's so beautiful. I don't want to touch it. I want to leave it.
Oh, I molest it. And mine's totally molested.
Well, and when I'm researching, I have books, I'm writing in them all the time because that's how I take my notes.
Me too. But we were taught in school not to mark up our books. Tosca, Haley is a social media goddess. I will watch her. She'll be on Twitch. She'll be playing in front of hundreds of people, sometimes thousands. People pay her to watch. The odd thing about online streaming is that if you like somebody's gaming and you like their personality and you feel it's almost like this podcast, right? They show up and they can watch Haley playing, but she's also talking to them. So it's very entertaining. She's like a broadcaster and she has her broadcast journalism degree. So she's talking to them while she's playing, but she's also rocking Twitter at the same time. It is the craziest thing. No, you can't even imagine. I've seen her rocking Twitter. She's posting on IG. She's playing. She's broadcasting. She's talking. She's collecting donations. They donate so that they can keep her on the air. It's nuts. And then at the same time, she's also got advertisers watching. So she's maybe doing a sponsorship with Intel or Sony or whatever it is. She has a lot of corporations. Anyway, it's pretty nuts. But my question to you is, how are you feeling about this social media experience that we're all, us authors who started out before there was social media, we're all having to navigate? Whereas with somebody like Haley, it's kind of second nature because they grew up with it. Or I think so. Haley, I'm putting words in your mouth, so correct me.
True.
But how do you navigate it? Because it's kind of intense. You're a writer, you're on a deadline, you've got to be really focused, and yet you've also got to be rocking social media. What the WTF?
It's hard because, you know, you could spend literally all day on all the different social media platforms doing that. In my case, to keep my readers engaged.
Right.
They want to know what your life is like and they want to know you. So I find it to be kind of a balancing act. It's a lot of work, really.
Definitely. people don't really understand how much, especially Instagram, I think takes because you're putting so much effort into what you post, how it looks, what time you post it, the like your peak hours of when the engagement's going to be highest to help grow those things. Because ultimately as a business, your social media is an asset, right?
Oh, yeah.
One of the first things that I do when I finish a book is I want to know more either about the author or I want to know when the next book is coming out. So I'll look them up, right?
Always.
And so I want to know like who just published this beautiful piece of work that I just read and learn more about them. So I think social media is really important for you, for me, for everybody who is, I guess, their own boss in this case. And it's a big commitment, right? It's to stay connected to your community. And I think we have that in common because my community is the same way. They want to know what's going on outside of the stream and when I'll be live next. And for you, they want to know, okay, when's the sequel coming? And tell me more about Winter and Chase. And they have these questions. And I'm sure it's probably difficult to field those all while you're like, oh, it's coming. I'm busy writing it. But I'm also trying to answer this for you while on social media. Like, I imagine that's difficult to juggle.
Well, it is. And you have to also kind of become an expert on those things because you have to know how to work all that stuff. And it's changing and evolving all the time. So it takes a lot of time. And it's not something that you can really farm out very well because I've tried that. But it needs to sound like you and it needs to come from you.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's also upsetting to the fan when it's not you. I've heard Elizabeth Gilbert say many times, hey guys, just so you know, it's me. I'm the one doing this. And I remember I befriended a gal from this podcast. She was on the podcast. She's just a phenomenal writer and a great human being. And she and I were somewhere together and I had said something to her on Twitter and the month before, and she said, oh, by the way, thank you for what you posted about Twitter. I just saw it. And I said, but you answered it. And she said, oh, that wasn't me. I have somebody who does all my stuff. And I just thought, oh, it was a little bit disappointing. And I thought, I would rather have fewer followers and be the one who's authentically posting and talking to people who are writing to me than have somebody represent me. You know, we're online connecting with people. They're quote unquote not friends, but they are friends. It's just what you said, Haley. You fall in love with somebody's work and you reach out to them. Well, you're reaching out to them because you care about them. So to me, social media followers are friends you haven't met yet and you are meeting them. So to not be doing it, it just feels a little inauthentic.
Yeah.
I agree. Even bigger names like actors and people that you wouldn't necessarily expect, you go on and it says like all of their tweets are just shared posts from Instagram, or they're just generic posts about their upcoming work. And it's like, that's why people like Anna Kendrick, like she's so, if you go to her Twitter, she, girlfriend is hysterical.
Is she?
Oh gosh, yes. Of course, when you have the opportunity to see these people and their personality, oh my God, she's amazing. I think her pinned tweet is how she forgot she was in Twilight. Like she's just hysterical. And so you find people like this and you tend to fall in love with their personality even more. Same thing with like Jennifer Lawrence. I'm always
hilarious. That
she doesn't have Twitter and it kills me because I feel like she would bring so much to the silly website.
So funny.
Yeah. She'd be amazing. So I think that people want to get to know you on a deeper level. So not being authentic, not having your own thoughts and content on there, I think loses a lot of appeal towards your audience.
I think it does. That said, it is a real commitment. And
yep.
I have to warn people sometimes, look, I'm really, really far behind in answering not just email, but Facebook messages. Mm-hmm. Because you add all those inboxes up, it's easy to get really behind. I'm embarrassingly behind, but yeah. I answer it. It's me.
Now, how does your husband... In fact, how do both of your husbands handle the fact that they have to share you with so many people? What is that like for you, Tosca?
I think it was a little different for my husband because he's shy. He's a very shy person. But that said, people really gravitate towards him and really like him.
He's a farmer, right?
He's a farmer and he's hot. He's super. He's on Instagram as the Farmer Brian. And he's a, yeah. If there were like a calendar of farmers, he would be in it. So,
oh, wow.
But he goes with me to things and people really enjoy meeting him and talking with him. So I think it's very different and it was a very new experience kind of coming into this world, but he's adapted really well. And I just try to take him with me when I can and when he's able to go.
And when he knows that you're under deadline, is he cool about these 20 hours or 24 hours where you're not, I mean, you're smelly, but you're actually not fun?
No, I'm not. You know, he's fabulous because as a farmer too, you know, he has his busy times of the year during planting and harvest when I'm running kids around and I'm cooking and feeding him and running food out to the fields. And he's running food upstairs to the attic where I'm working in the farmhouse and making me cookies from scratch if I'm like, hey, I need a cookie. So
mine does that too.
He's fabulous. Yeah.
Haley's dad loves to cook. He's such a good cook. And if I ask for junk food, oh, no problem. He won't cook me anything healthy, but he'll cook junk food, no problem.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. It's true.
His I love radish junk sandwiches.
Food. Wait, what did you say? His what, Haley?
His radish sandwiches that he makes. He makes like this English muffin and he puts like mayo and sliced radishes on it.
That's with, and butter.
I know it sounds horrible, but the mayo and the butter, and it's like the only healthy part is the radish.
That's the healthiest
thing. A radish sandwich?
I know it sounds disgusting, but I promise you, like, I thought the same thing. My dad came up to me and he's like, have you ever had a radish sandwich? I'm like, why would I ever eat that?
I've never heard of that.
I know. And he goes, oh, just wait. And he makes it for me. And sure enough, it was phenomenal. So
really?
If you're ever in LA, we'll have you over and you can have one of these radish sandwiches. I'll have my dad make one for all of us.
Yeah.
We need a picture on Instagram in the meantime. We need a photo.
Oh, I have one. We'll do it next weekend, Haley, when we're together.
I'm pretty sure I posted a picture on my Instagram last time he made one. Okay, so I have one more question, because you've written your Books of Mortals trilogy with New York Times bestseller Ted Decker. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the difference between writing solo and writing with a partner.
Mm.
Well, writing with a partner takes more time, at least in my experience, because you have to discuss everything. You have to talk it all out. In some cases, you have to compromise. It takes a lot more thought. And if you're sharing the writing, meaning if you're taking turns laying down that first draft, it takes a lot of communication, a lot of back and forth. And when we started writing, our voices were so different that we would pass the writing back and forth and rewrite each other's writing several times in order to blend that voice. And so it was really time consuming. By the third book in that series, though, things had sped up because you get the system down. Then it was fast. You've learned to trust each other. That's another part of writing in partnership that takes time, is trusting one another.
Yeah.
You know each other's strengths, which is really important anytime you do, not just a writing partnership, but any partnership. You need to know one another's strengths and what you're bringing to the table. So it is different though. And you know how I said that sometimes when you're in the process, things just happen. There were a few times when I was writing the first draft and it was like, it was time for this character to go. And I wrote it and I passed it over and Ted called me the next day and he's like, you just killed this character. And I said, yeah, that wasn't in the outline because we had outlined it and discussed it. And I said, yeah, but it was his time and just let him go, man. Let him go.
I feel like that would be so shocking. You just read back the draft and you're like, wait, what?
When you're doing it though, it just felt like the right thing. It was like, oh, he's got to die. Yeah,
Did he disagree?
Well, we ended up finding a compromise on that one. So yeah, we found some middle ground.
That's good though. That's good that you have somebody you're doing it with that you can find the middle ground over. Because I feel like it's such a personal process that it would be challenging to be able to let go of certain things you feel need to happen. So trust you, that's got to be a difficult challenge.
Yeah, it can be. But I think that there are some writing partnerships that probably don't quite make it and fall apart.
I haven't had any blow up, but just recently I had done a talk on time debt and I wanted to bring in a co-author because I thought, I've got too many other books going. I'm never going to finish this on my own. And it felt kind of timely. So I brought in a writer that I love and we are having the most amazing time. But I was a little superstitious at first. I thought this could be really hard and I don't know that I want to do this. I haven't co-authored in a long time. I'm kind of used to doing my own thing. Mm-hmm. So I called my sister, who's an astrologer, and I'm woo-woo like that. And I said, hey, check out her birth data. So my sister calls me up. She goes, Linda, you have the most highly compatible intellectual relationship with this woman I've ever seen, maybe. So I called up Brahma and I said, let's do it. And it has been so delightful.
Wow.
She'll write a chapter and she'll send it to me and I will look at it and I'll think it's amazing. And I'll write her back and I'll say, you killed it. It is phenomenal. Wow. And then I'll go to bed and I'll have 72 ideas for how to change it. And I'll completely rewrite it and send it back to her. And she doesn't get at all irritated. There's never been a hurt feeling. I'll spend 3 weeks completely dismantling it and using a lot of what she said, but just rewriting it. And then she'll do the same thing with me. You know, I'll write something, I'll send it to her and she'll say, I love it. And then she'll think about it and she'll go, but so-and-so did something similar, or this sounds like something we already have in chapter 8, or I don't know about this thought, Linda. I actually think you made that bullshit up, and we'll just laugh. It is so delightful. And what's taking a long time because we're both really busy, but we're not urgent. And I just feel such a weight off my shoulders knowing that somebody else is in this with me. I wouldn't have carried this topic this far by myself.
Well, and I think that's the whole reason for partnership is to do something or create something that you could not have done on your own, right?
Yeah. It's that whole two or more gathered. It just feels like what's being birthed is bigger and better than anything either of us could have done individually on this topic.
Yeah.
All right. So is there anything that we didn't discuss, Tosca, that you want to discuss?
You know, the only other thing I'd really want to say is I just want to say how much I love readers. And I want to shout out some love to my readers.
Oh.
They're fabulous. And I'm so grateful to anybody who reads not just my books, but any books.
Yeah.
And so grateful to get to write. And just, I love them. So I just want to say that.
It's beautiful.
I love it.
I think one of the things they love about you, which is the same thing that Haley and I love about you, is that, you know, that Marianne Williamson quote that I've actually heard you quote before, which is that our deepest fear is that we're powerful beyond measure. And
yeah,
you really stand for unlimitedness. There is such strength and courage. You may be shy and you may be an introvert, but you're a powerful force, Tosca. Oh,
thank you.
And it comes through in your voice, on the page. It comes through just even sitting here. I love how you say there's nothing enlightened about shrinking and that we were born to manifest the glory of God.
Yeah. I love that quote because I feel like we shrink so often out of our own fear or out of fear of offending by standing up to our full potential.
Yeah.
Which is silly. And I think anytime you do your best, you can only inspire other people. But I am inspired by these readers who have let me into their lives, and I'm so grateful to be a part of their lives and to be in their homes, even if only by my books.
Yeah. It's an honor, isn't it?
It is an honor.
Day and age when we're all so busy and everybody's got so many things they need to put their money toward, it's such an honor when they'll pick up your work and pay for it,
yeah,
and enjoy it and share it. And Haley, what I said about Tosca applies to you too. You know, from the minute I met you were only 17 when I met you. I'll never forget the first day your dad brought you to my house. And I thought, that woman is so powerful. You're such a force and you are so authentically who you are. And I think it's why you have such a wide following as well, Haley, because you do not shrink. You shine your light bright and it's an honor to be in your life.
Those are very kind words. And I will say that I am very inspired after doing this today with you ladies because, and Linda knows this very well, that writing is something that I've always wanted to pursue and do plan to pursue. It's just a matter of, I think you really hit the nail on the head when you say fearing you're reaching your fullest potential. I think that's something that a lot of people experience and don't know how to overcome. And I think that this podcast and this hour with you guys has really kind of helped me see a little bit more perspective on that. So thank you for that.
I love it.
I'm so glad. And Haley, Linda is so proud of you.
I am.
Thank you.
It's so obvious and she's very, very proud.
I am.
I'm proud to have her in my life too. So we're all just lovey-dovey, wonderful women, aren't we? I'm here for it.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for being here and being
on
my little show.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Tosca, it was such a pleasure talking to you.
Such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much, ladies. Thank you. This was such a pleasure. I truly appreciate it.
I'm so excited. And please go put that sequel out into the world quickly, please.
Okay.
Seriously, we're both waiting.
Okay. It's coming. It's coming.
My heart is so full right now. I loved so many things about that conversation. Mixing family and books is always a favorite pastime, but to have Tosca join the mix, I just feel so blessed. I loved when Haley said that writing novels in 6 weeks or 9 years, same thing. Or when Tosca said she doesn't sleep with a cross over her bed, but maybe she should. Or how when she's naming a character after a reader, she reserves the right to make them a jerk or kill them. Classic. You can enter Tosca's thrilling world over at toscalee.com, where you can get links to The Line Between and all of her many books. Haley Baez is all over social media. Look for Haley Nick. That's HaylyNic. That's her handle on Twitter, Instagram, and on Twitch. As for me and my writing retreats in Carmel by the Sea, all those links are living over on bookmama.com or beautifulwriterspodcast.com. Until next time, write on.